When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Today on Truth and Movies, the dead rise again in the belated ZomCom sequel Zombieland Double Tap.
You'll be the first to die, but I like your enthusiasm.
Director Olivier Sayas is discontent with digital content in the French publishing drama Non-Fiction. And in Film Club, Maggie Cheung plays herself in Sayas' film-within-a-film drama Irma Vep.
I like latex.
Latex?
Latex?
Like plastic. Oh, rubber.
Or coming up in Truth and Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. And here we are. Welcome, movie truthers, to another episode. It's Michael Leader here, sitting across this week from David Jenkins.
Hey, hey.
And Elena Lazic.
Hello.
Elena, welcome back. It's been a long time,
I know,
it feels like.
I missed
like.
You guys.
How have you been?
Not bad, yeah, very well.
So the LFF, the London Film Festival, has just finished. Do we have highlights we can share with the audience?
I thought, in general, it was a very good one this year.
I agree.
Lots of top stuff.
Any standout films?
I went along to the closing gala, which was The Irishman, the new Martin Scorsese film, which is, I think, is coming out on Netflix in like beginning of November, which is good. It had been in the New York Film Festival and it had received these kind of rapturous rave reviews there, and I'm still having to let it kind of percolate a little bit longer, I think, because there's a lot in there, and it's a big old film, runs at like 3.5 hours, and it covers 60 years of ground of this chap who, played by Robert De Niro, Frank Sheenan, who's a kind of mob lieutenant who is kind of divides his time between a mafioso played by Joe Pesci and Jimmy Hoffa, who is like a union boss played by Al Pacino. I'm sure we'll cover it on the pod on the relevant week,
yeah.
But the thing I will say is Al Pacino in particular, I thought, was extraordinary in the film. And I know you're never meant to think like, oh, I wish X director had made this film instead of that film. And because, you know, you got to review what has been made, not as what has not been made. But I couldn't help but think, oh, I would have loved a Pacino, Jimmy Hoffa film with him as the sort of central player rather than, I mean, De Niro's character is the kind of linchpin of the film, and he's maybe a little less interesting than the other two characters, but still very good film.
That's out really soon, isn't it? It's coming.
Yeah.
There's a sort of limited but sort of wide release coming in early November, and then it's on Netflix end of that month.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
And it's 3.5 hours long. Right?
Yeah, but you know, if you've seen Goodfellas or Casino, I mean, Casino's 3 hours, and that absolutely whips by. You know, so it's a little bit more laconic than the usual Scorsese film. I mean, you know, Wolf of Wall Street was, you know, it was very kind of
snappy,
dramatic, even though this one is a little bit more pensive, I think, in tone. It still rattles along.
I can't wait to see it. Ellen, did you see anything?
I didn't see The Irishman, but I saw Bad Education from the director of Thoroughbreds, and I loved it. Like, it's actually hard to talk about without spoiling it too much, because there's obviously it's the film starring Hugh Jackman, and everything that unfolds is just incredible when you know who Hugh Jackman is. Like, it just feels like he keeps making these films where he's trying to tell us who he is. And like, this one is like, yeah, this is me. This is me. Yeah, no, literally. And he's so good in the film, and he gets to play such a complex character. Like, he plays this guy who seems to be just a perfect person, like just a genuinely great person, but he's got some secrets. If that's not Hugh Jackman, like, I don't know who that is. This film is like really playing with his persona as this very like nice man who like loves everybody and is always enthusiastic about everything. And like, it's so brilliant. It's funny because it's about like money and corruption and things, but I found it so emotional. and human, and because it's about all these people like being greedy, but I haven't seen many films like this that actually make you care for them. Obviously, it's awful everything that they're doing, but you actually care for them, and it's so sad. I was kind of blown away by it.
That's terrific. I can't wait to see it. Thoroughbreds, I thought, was quite cold. This sounds like something different.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I was very surprised. I expected something very, like, you know, clinical, but it really isn't like that.
Oh, we have two recommendations here from listener Paul Reeve, who says, LFF is always a highlight of the year for me, a great chance to see films I know nothing about, hopefully with the director there to tell us more about it. I particularly enjoyed Monos, a gripping and visceral story of teenage soldiers in Colombia. And also the style and subject of The Last Black Man in San Francisco. Hopefully we'll be covering these when they get UK released later this month. Yeah, they're both out really soon, those films. I think in the next 2-3 weeks.
Yeah, yeah. And I think both set for this very podcast, I believe.
Anyway, that's the London Film Festival. David, you've also been busy with other things as well. We have an interview coming up later in the show.
Yeah, yeah. There's another film coming out, a slightly smaller release, a film called General Magic. It's like a documentary about a Silicon Valley 90s tech startup. All sort of nerdy guys in thick glasses and fish t-shirts and eating cookies for breakfast, lunch and dinner. And it's the story of this company who made the first palm top laptop, you know, like a kind of handheld...
Like a PDA.
PDA touchscreen device. And in the kind of history of Silicon Valley, General Magic are like super important, but the kind of layperson has probably never heard of them because their rise was... very, very quick, and their fall was even quicker. So I met one of the guys who worked there, a guy called Tony Fadell. He went on to invent the iPod and create the iPod and co-create the iPhone. So parlaying all his experience that we see in the film into making these very kind of revolutionary devices.
That sounds terrific. We'll hear more about that later in the programme, but first we should deal with this week's new releases. Up first we have Zombieland Double Tap. Ten years after the first Zombieland comes this sequel that reunites what is now something of an all-star cast. Columbus, Tallahassee, Wichita and Little Rock, that's Jesse Eisenberg, Woody Harrelson, Emma Stone and Abigail Breslin, respectively, all move to the American heartland as they face off against evolved zombies, fellow survivors and the growing pains of their snarky makeshift family.
Welcome back to Zombieland. It's been 10 years since the outbreak.
Oh my God, we're back again.
Let's get you up to speed. Columbus formed an unlikely alliance with Tallahassee. On the road, they met sisters in crime, Little Rock and Wichita. Columbus fell in love with Wichita, and Tallahassee became the father Little Rock never wanted. All of this resulting in a loving yet highly dysfunctional family.
Yeah!
For survival, they live by a strict set of rules. Like rule number 25, shoot first.
Oh my God, I'm so sorry, I'm Columbus.
Madison, is this your dad? Oh, whoopsie, I forgot the seatbelt rule.
But this year, the rules will change.
This new kind of zombie, stronger, faster, better adapted to the hunt.
There's only one thing we can do.
Group sex.
Oh.
Right?
You'll be the first to die, but I like your enthusiasm.
Let's kick some dicks.
The trailer for Zombieland Double Tap there. Elena, do we need this sequel? There's so much excitement for it.
I don't know if there was much excitement for it. I hadn't seen the original film, so I watched it for this podcast. And, you know, it is what it is. And then I went to see the second one, and it's basically the same movie. So I don't know. I mean, maybe there are people who are nostalgic for the first film that actually came out a whole 10 years ago. But I wasn't one of them because I wasn't a fan of the first film. But it's just so strange because, so there are all these jokes, obviously, in the first movie. And apparently they're classic jokes now because in the second film they just redo them, supposedly, I think, for the sake of nostalgia. But because, one, I don't find them funny. And second, I just watched the film 2 days ago, so in the first film. So it doesn't feel like nostalgia for me. It just feels like they had no new ideas. And so they're just retreading the same sort of jokes, except removing some offensive ones and adding differently offensive ones.
The film back in 2009 was moderately well received and successful.
Right.
I think everybody involved went on to bigger and greater things. In fact, look at the poster, and it's billed as from the director of Venom, who is the director of Zombieland as well. So they're even billing Ruben Fleischer differently now. But it was still at this time where zombies were having their moment with The Walking Dead on television, and it felt, even though it was later than Shaun of the Dead, somewhat radical for a mainstream Hollywood comedy to be doing a zombie comedy. You've been on this show before talking about horror. Mm. Is this at all an interesting spin on the genre?
No, I don't think so, because it's like, obviously, you know, we've just heard in the trailer that he has all these rules for survival, which I guess, you know, it's sort of interesting. Like, he's this nerdy guy who has, I think, watched zombie movies and things, so he knows how to deal with them. But apart from that, like, it's just the actual rules on how to kill zombies are kind of basic and random, and you just wonder, like, why don't they, how hard is it? Like, mm-hmm. you can just go and kill all the zombies, surely. And in the 10 years that has passed, how are there still zombies? Like, surely they could have just killed all of them? Mm-hmm. I mean, that was my first thought when I watched the film. But I don't know, it's just like, yeah, it's like all these tropes that, instead of being treated as like, you know, because I think the potential of the zombie movie is either, you know, you can do social commentary, obviously we've seen that with the Romero films, but also you could just do like something that's actually really scary. Like, one of my favorite zombie films is 30 Days of Night, which I think is brilliant and underrated, but that's generally scary and like, you know, it's awful. And like the idea of like people you love being transformed, which is sort of touched on in those films, is just not, it's kind of, everything in the Zombieland films is just kind of ironic, so you just don't really care about anything, which I think is a shame, because the concept of the zombie is already like obviously far-fetched, so if you're adding irony, sort of ironic engagement with that on top of it, it just makes it a bit like mind-numbing, really.
David, we were just talking earlier, you reviewed this in one of your previous lives. You reviewed the first Zombieland in one of your previous lives. What did you give it?
It was probably a 3-star. Uh-huh. I think I'd give everything 3-star. I sort of remember it being sort of passably okay, with a few bits and bobs in there and a few sort of self-referential things that, I mean, I think it maybe felt more unique at the time. But going back to what you were saying about nostalgia, how can we be nostalgia for something that we've completely forgotten, you know? Mm. And that just makes me think, well, maybe there is someone who is nostalgic for it, and that is director Ruben Fleischer. It strikes me as maybe, you know, he had the sequel raring to go, the original didn't do the numbers that were expected or wasn't as successful enough to maybe warrant a sequel at the time. Then he goes off and does Venom. It's this huge box office success. And then, you know, they're like, Ruben, baby, what do you want to do? You've got a carte blanche here. So he's like, well, I've got this thing in my drawer that I'd love to clear out. And this is very kind of, you know, conspiracy theory-esque, I really realise. But the film is so, like, unnecessary and doesn't serve any audience or any kind of cultural need or doesn't have anything, even within its own world, have anything original to offer. It's pure kind of rehash. You can imagine, had it come out like the year after Zombieland, it would have been a kind of, oh yeah, you know, with the sort of vague memory of that in our mind, we can kind of imagine this plot went on a little bit further. Mm-hmm. But with that 10-year chasm in the middle, you just think, what? Could they not have done something with this? The weird thing about this is, there's no concept. There's no, like, idea behind it. You know, like in Romero, each sort of iteration of the zombies is a slight change. And by the third one, they're almost being
domesticated
almost. Yes. And there's a vague hint at the beginning that it's going to be more like that, because they say, yeah, the zombies have changed. But you get into the film, it's like, no, they kind of haven't really. No, and even the sort of, in, you know, what they mentioned there, this kind of, this new sort of super breed T-800 hunting zombie, that doesn't really mean anything in the film. They don't cause any sort of special threat or anything, and you know, nothing happens to anyone.
I actually saw Zombieland 2 with friends who told me that they were fans of the first one when 10 years ago when they were kids, and they watched it like repeatedly. So for them, it was a big deal. So there are, I think, fans out there.
And did they like
the first
this?
Zombieland? Well, no. So I can obviously believe that they were fans of the first one, but they're 10 years older now. Like, they might not be interested in Zombieland 2, especially if you just make it the same. If you make it like a sort of grown-up version, like, there are so many ways this could have gone to be like interesting. Like, I mean, in the space of 10 years, which in the film, it's also been 10 years, because I guess, I mean, they can't lie, the actors are clearly 10 years older.
Even though Jesse Eisenberg doesn't.
He doesn't look any different, no. They could have done so many things. Like, maybe one of them could have died. Like, they could have, I don't know, like, so many things could have happened, and they just try to tell us that, oh, they're just the same, I'm like, how is that possible? 10 years, like, they're just the same as they were the last book.
But that's the intriguing thing. One of the things that I remember quite liking about the first one was the cast they assembled felt like they'd brought in an indie comedy cast. Apart from Woody Harrelson, they were up and comers. You had Abigail Breslin, who was in Little Miss Sunshine, Jesse Eisenberg just coming off Social Network, and Emma Stone. 10 years on, thinking of the ups and downs, the rise and fall of these stars, has Abigail Breslin been in anything in the last 10 years? I actually had to look up her IMDb.
She's been in a few bits and bobs.
Emma Stone has had how many Oscar-nominated and winning roles since then? Jesse Eisenberg has been Lex Luthor in that time and been and gone. And Woody Harrelson is still there pumping out the films. How do they perform? Do they even sit on screen in the same way now?
Emma Stone is a weird one, I think. I don't know about you guys, but like, I'm not a massive fan of her kind of, since she's sort of been thrown into the limelight as this great actress and has got all these Oscar nominations, I've never been that interested or impressed by those big performances she's given. I recently like caught up with some of her films earlier in her career where she was more of a kind of comic support player. Like, there's this movie, The House Bunny. Mm-hmm. Have you ever seen The House Bunny?
I have not.
It's really good. It's about a playboy bunny who moves into a university dorm and basically makes the fellow women in the dorm more fun and less nerdy. And Emma Stone's one of the nerdy girls, and she's really funny in it. And in this film, you have like a similar character played by Zoe Deutsch.
I don't know
how
actually.
Zoe Deutsch.
Who is this kind of blonde bimbo kind of thing who has sort of survived by locking herself in a big freezer in a mall, and I actually think she's like the best thing in the film because she's
agree.
Actually the only one who seems to be like doing something and like trying to build a character, trying to act, trying to be funny. It's quite cruel how she ends up being the butt of all the jokes in the end by the other guys. But then Emma Stone used to, you know, was so great in those kind of roles and made so much of them, and it's like Zoe Deutsch is like taken over from that, and I just felt Emma Stone in this film, she's like, they've like said, oh, okay, you can wear your leather bomber jacket and your tight jeans and nothing's going to happen to you, you're not going to have to like have any goo put on you, or you're not going to have to fight anyone. And she doesn't really do anything in the film.
That's a shame.
She didn't even do that much in the first one, but she does even less in this one, I think.
You know, you're reminiscing about Emma Stone's supporting comedy roles. Reminds me of, I wonder if you've seen this film, David. I don't think you have. The Ghosts of Girlfriends Past.
I have seen it.
She's great in that as the Ghost of Girlfriends Past.
Because I recently rewatched all Matthew McConaughey films.
Right.
She is the kind of mad girlfriend. And she's incredible in that.
In that strange rom-com remake of Christmas Carol.
Yeah. Good film.
I'm going to watch that Christmas.
Yeah, yeah. I'd recommend that, Eleanor, yeah.
It's on my watch list.
One of the only things people remember about the original Zombieland, apart from those people who've watched it many times as kids, is the Bill Murray cameo. Does this one serve any surprises like that? That might be one thing that can tempt people into the cinema. Is that already a spoiler? I mean, on this list there's already Dan Aykroyd as himself.
Yeah, I guess there is. Yeah, you know, if people stay post credits, there's a little fun thing. Nothing in the actual main body of the film though. A little addendum that's, you know, there.
Well, let's cut off the head to finish Zombieland forever. Let's put some scores on it in anticipation, enjoyment, in retrospect. Eleanor?
I mean, anticipation, I don't know, 2, because I didn't want this. I mean, I wasn't expecting this film. I didn't care about it. Enjoyment, the same, because I actually found it more grueling than the first one, because there are some jokes that are just not funny, and there are some really, really funny one-liners that I think whoever came up with them, like, deserves a medal. But most of the time, the jokes are just not very funny, and there's nothing worse than watching a movie
that's not actually funny.
It's
nasty humour. It's written by the guy who did Deadpool, so it's got that kind of,
well, that makes sense. I mean, there are some, like, offensive jokes, like, as you said, the Zoe Deutsch character is, like, it's just so, you know, offensive. But even the ones that are not very offensive are not very funny. So I was just like, oh, God, this is embarrassing. And also, all these actors are, like, pretty big now. And so to see them in this film, I just think, like, oh, what were you thinking in this moment? Like, how is it to be in the studio and, like, on the set doing this film 10 years after the first one? And now they've moved on so much. So, yeah, it was kind of, like, very depressing in that sense. So I would say enjoyment, like, I don't know, 1. And in retrospect, I don't know, 2, to be nice. It's not that bad. There are worse films, but I wouldn't watch that again.
David?
2-2-1. I mean, it was like, actually, no, 1-2-1.
Oh. But you gave the first one 3 stars.
I know. But, I mean, there's even a bit where Woody Harrelson has all these like little catchphrases when they're about to go and kill some zombies. He'll be like, let's X some Y or something, you know. Mm. And there's a bit was like, oh, you really need to refresh your catchphrases. And it's like, yeah. You need to refresh the whole thing.
Well, that's Zombieland Double Tap. Up next, we're going to go from Double Tap to Double V, which is the French title of our next film, Nonfiction. Alain, a successful Parisian publisher struggling to adapt to the digital revolution, rejects the latest piece of veiled autobiography from author Lenard. But little does he know, Leonard is having an affair with his wife, and soon events force them into confronting their double lives in a comedy of art, affairs, and midlife crises. I must say, this is a strange film. The first scene starts, and you have beautiful, compelling French actors talking at length about the switch from print to digital.
Yes.
And I think, this is interesting, it's setting up its stall in the first scene, and then the plot will kick in. But no, the whole film is that, right?
In a good way, I think. You know, Olivier Assayas is a director who is, you know, he's really plugged into the kind of shifts and currents of modern culture and technology, and is interested in discussing these ideas, or at least placing these fictional dramas into the context of how the world is changing, and how people's jobs are changing, and how art is changing, and how we consume art is changing. I guess if you look back over his career, he does various different types of movies, and this is one of his more kind of like literary, intellectual, after dinner conversational pieces, which he does alongside these historical, almost sort of thrillery dramas. He's already made another film called Wasp Network, which was in the London Film Festival, about Cuban dissidents. So it's like a very, very completely different prospect to this. You know, it's a very French film. Mm-hmm. I've read some reviews of it that sort of maybe complain a little about the fact that it feels like a slightly older guy griping about how his sort of nice, cozy, analog, tangible world of art and literature is kind of falling away from him and sort of ushering in this new world of ephemeral digital things, and marketing people are sort of taking over the conversation, and the actual medium of how we write books and how people read books is actually changing what those books that are written are. And it sort of interweaves all these sort of questions into this almost like a kind of bedroom farce, where you have one guy who's friends with another guy, and he's sleeping with his wife, and he's got a girlfriend, and the girlfriend's got, you know, is working somewhere else, and it's a sort of little cross-section of literary bourgeois Paris. And so Juliette Binoche is the publisher's wife, and she wears these incredible pullovers, and her job is she's like a sort of lead SWAT team.
The running gag is that everyone thinks that she's playing a cop on a TV show,
and she corrects them.
She's not a cop. She actually has a different rank.
Yes,
a different role.
And it's real kind of like lowbrow TV filler kind of stuff that she's in. But she's got a sort of measure of fame from that, and I think she sort of uses that to sort of keep herself within this sort of literary circle. I think she's really funny in the film, and in a way, like the film reminded me a lot of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, the Tarantino film, because you know, all the characters are in a way like mouthpieces for the director and the director's ideas about culture. And I think that maybe Assayas does a little bit more to conceal that in the way that the drama plays out in a more realistic way. And I think he's sort of tapping into more realistic emotions in the kind of humiliations that the author Leonard goes through when he's has his book rejected, and then he's you know, there's a Q&A event where he's asked all these awkward questions about how he kind of processes his real life and transforms it into fiction, and the sort of ethical moral imperatives behind that. I think there's a lot going on in the film. I think if people find it like intensely smug, I would sort of agree with them. Mm-hmm. But it worked for me.
I think mouthpiece is the right word here. You interviewed Olivier Assayas for the magazine, right? And if you read that interview, which is up on the website now, his answers could just be pasted into the screenplay here and be one of the monologues that one of the actors gives.
Yeah.
And it is that, as you say, it's a farce where there's bed swapping, but then the morning after, while they're getting dressed, they're saying, and what about that ebook?
They're talking about the ebook revolution and like, you know, publishing companies going through like massive changes.
Yeah. So. That's why when you said that it's actually quite concealed, the mouthpiece element, I'm like, I don't know if I agree because...
A bit more.
Yeah, but obviously because I speak French, so I don't need the subtitles. But like, I could when they have this big conversation at the house of the publisher, I think, and all these friends are there, and they're all talking about publishing. I mean, it doesn't feel realistic, but I don't mind. It's not criticism, but it just absolutely doesn't feel realistic to me. But that's kind of the fun of it, I think. It's like kind of very artificial and sort of intellectual, but I think interesting. Like, I mean, imagine a director making a film about that actually explains the issue of digital content. Imagine if people watch this film and they understand the problem and then they start thinking about it. I mean, I don't think that's his intention. I don't think he's trying to like teach people, but I think it's very valuable to have that out there. If you have no other reason to see this film, but you're curious about like the state of like digital publishing, which I guess in this film is obviously he's talking also about cinema. Like he chose publishing just as a way to pretend, I guess, that it's not about the film industry. But like if nothing else, it's a very interesting way to understand the issues because you just sit there with all these beautiful French actors and very funny as well and sexy explaining to you like the challenges of the digital era. And it's kind of fascinating.
It is very engrossing in its way. You know, Guillaume Canet and Julie Binoche are just some of the best actors you can have in a film of this, and it's a gorgeous-looking film.
Guillaume Canet is always underrated, I think, because he's obviously in France, he's also very, very popular, like in popular films. You know, he makes the Little White Lies movies, but he's also like just an incredible actor, and I don't know if people really acknowledge that. Like, I think he's incredible in everything I've ever seen him in.
It did make me think about halfway through, there'd be riots in the streets if there was a British version of this made.
Exactly.
The amount that class is on everyone's mind, the sort of smugness and the upper middle class bubble this film is in. And if there was just, who would you even cast in a film like this? It would be Emma Thompson and
Hugh Grant. It's Notting Hill, basically.
But Notting Hill without the romantic
plot. It's Notting Hill, but they're talking about like
having closed the bookshop.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. But is that what Olivier Assayas can do? He can pull off this? Because he's been making these self-reflexive films within films before, you know, casting Maggie Cheung in so many films, because and he was with her at the time, and same with Clouds of Silmaria, which was it proved or was it apocryphal that Juliette Binoche took the role in the Godzilla movie as research for Clouds of Silmaria, in which she plays an actress taking a Hollywood role? But that's what he does, right? It's these, this puzzle box structure of his films.
One of the things that came out of the interview with him, I'm not sure how much I included of it, but like we did talk a lot about sort of digital culture and these questions about technology. The questions that people are asking now are probably very different to the questions that are addressed in this film. When you're doing something that's so contemporary and so, you know, dealing with this very specific moment in time, it sort of it becomes instantly nostalgic. And he was saying that even when he was writing it, between writing it and filming it, you know, he could have been constantly updating it because things were constantly changing and like ideas were changing and ideas were developing and technology was moving on during the process. So it's a film that sort of, you know, you have to just take the moment and just run with it, like, and say, this is going to be about this specific time and these specific characters. And it reaches a point where he kind of makes it, knowing that when it's seen like 6 months later at a festival, it is going to feel a little bit out of date. I mean, you have all these weird things now where people are like, oh, you know, something you read in so many reviews now is like, oh, this is one of the great films of the Trump era. And like this specific thing that's happening right now in the White House, this scandal. And then you're like, well, wow, this film was like written 4 years ago and filmed 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. And Mark, you know, and there's no way they could have like anticipated this. So you kind of get these instances where you kind of just have to connect a film to a moment. And if it works, it works. If it doesn't. And I think this film, his whole thing was like, I want to make it as specific as possible. Mm. I want to be referencing companies and specific authors and specific books and link it to a moment. So it can have a kind of ongoing relevance in that way as a, almost a kind of historical thing rather than like trying to make it more broad, but make it more like relatable or like you know, about the moment. So
he says it in the interview with you, doesn't he, that film as a medium is almost cannot be content, because content has to be delivered in a stream. So TV series or music or anything, when it's this constant flow of information, is what is content, whereas film as a discrete object, in his definition, cannot therefore be turned into content. And I suppose that's what you're getting at there.
Yeah.
But I think it just makes it all of the discourse here feel a bit out of date, where it's presented almost as a revelation that people are reading books on smartphones and tablets and not e-readers. That feels at least 5 years out of date.
Yes.
But I think also it does definitely feel a bit outdated, but also you have to keep in mind that in France, I don't know about the book industry, but the film industry is, for filmmakers, is just so much healthier because of all these regulations against digital content, and like the theatrical windows are way, the time the film comes on cinemas, you can only see it in Netflix like months and months later. It's huge. So I think to have a director being even able to make a film about this is like a sign of like a pretty healthy industry for film industry in France, which I think it's like, it might feel a bit like outdated, and also like, oh, why is he complaining about this stuff that everyone's like, we're all up to date, you know, this is, you know, progress, evolution, we have to adapt. But it's also like his literal life and his livelihood. And I think it's brilliant that he has a voice and that he's able to make these films. Like, that's the thing, when you mentioned that if this film was done here, people would be like, oh, what a smug dude, you know, like, yeah, definitely. But also, I mean, directing is a, I guess, a bit of a smug thing to do, because it's like a very selfish thing to do. And I mean, it's like art, it's not like content. You're not thinking, I don't think he's ever thinking about viewers and what they're going to think, you know, when he makes his movies. And that's what's so brilliant. I mean, we're going to talk about this in the next one as well, but they're like, he makes these films and then he leaves them to you, do what you want with them, which is brilliant, which is the opposite of content.
Yeah, I think that crystallizes a key difference between British and French filmmaking and our approach to those films. And he is such a good catalyst for those conversations, and we'll continue with that conversation in Film Club shortly. But let's put some scores on this, David, for nonfiction.
Well, I'm just a big fan of Assayas, and I'd probably say fours across the board on this one. I really liked it. I'd happily watch it again. I often find myself coming back to his films, and he's also got a film from 2008 called Summer Hours, which I think if you like this film, definitely worth like revisiting that one as well.
Great. Eleanor?
I think I would probably say the same. I have to say, when I first watched the film, I was a bit confused, but I was like, why is this film like just about a debate about art and like publishing? But actually, yeah, I mean, our conversation and just thinking about it and seeing all the changes happening in the film industry, probably in the publishing industry as well, I think it kind of justifies its existence and makes it even more interesting. Like, at the same time as it might feel a bit dated, it also is a good way to like register the fact that there was another way of making books and also films, I guess, before all this.
I might give this 3.32. I there's something about his style of filmmaking that really puts me off, but the cast are so watchable, and I do enjoy talking about these films with you two. Anyway, go and see Zombieland Double Tap and Nonfiction and let us know what you think. But before we move on to Film Club, David, we should talk about General Magic and set up your interview.
So yeah, General Magic, it's a film out this week. It's a documentary. I think it's available on streaming. It's definitely on iTunes from this Friday. Yeah, it's this film about this tech startup from the 90s, and it sort of charts their rise and fall. As I said, they were some of the innovators of touchscreen technology, and very much a sort of antecedent to some of the technology that millions and millions of people use today, like iPhones and iPods. I don't know if people use iPods.
I think
still.
Well, there's some people used to. Producer Ian is just waving us through the booth there, saying that he has two. He has one spare in his desk.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, they're still out there, but you know, obviously these massive sort of epochal technological advances. And it's a fun film, and we interviewed this guy called Tony Fadell, who is the iPod inventor, iPhone co-inventor. He is the founder of a company called Nest, and also is a principal at a company called Future Shape, which do green energy and consulting and things like that, and was the inventor of this device called the Magic Link, which basically crashed and burned because the market wasn't quite ready for it. Imagine an iPhone at a time when nobody was using emails, MP3s didn't exist, and nobody was using text messages. there was no market for it at that time, but obviously he was able to kind of parlay his technological know-how into these other things. So, yeah, we just picked up the conversation about his work there.
General Magic was at a moment in time, and we were all, like, working together, and we were starting to do, like, the first sets of international email, because we were working with international teams. So, yeah, it was very, very fun, interesting time. And, you know, we had great times on the iPod. We had great times on the iPhone, Nest and other stuff. But it was a very different thing because it was all our own little nugget, right? We could keep it really secret and everything else. iPod was like that, but it was in a big structure. This was all our own. It was like our own little baby.
One of the things about General Magic, which is really interesting, which, you know, I'd love to know if it's something that you've experienced elsewhere, is this idea of, like, on one side, you're tech people, you're programming, you're engineering, but then also there's a sense that you're also artists as well. You are really interested in the artistry of what you were doing and sometimes got a bit carried away with it as well.
Absolutely.
And how important is that artistic element?
Well, I think art comes in different forms. You know, one thing that we all did at General Magic, and it wasn't in the film, but we all had titles beyond the function we did. So, like, my title was Silicon Sorcerer. So everybody had another magician kind of, like, title that was more magic-related or artist-related. And so we all believed that we were creating art, and art can come through code. Art can come through the documentation. It can come in many different forms. And so we were all treated as such. And that was wonderful because that carried on into how we did things moving ahead. And I think that was really born out of what Steve Jobs tried to do with the original Mac team, where Andy and Bill and Joanna and Susan and all these different people were treated like artists. And so they wanted to continue to treat the project as well as the people on the team like artists. And that gives you a whole different thing, that you're not just a cog in the machine. And this is true craft, and it can be passed down. So I was looking at, you know, working for my heroes, working with my heroes, but learning the craft the way they did it, right? The absolute masters.
I've got one more question for you. I'd love to have a bit of insight from you on, you obviously have worked on the iPod, and you've, you know, worked towards revolutionizing the way that people around the world listen to music. As someone who has that ability to kind of peek just over the horizon, what are your insights into the way that people watch films and how that's going to change? Is that something that you're interested in?
Well, I'm always interested in where society is going for consumption of different things. Music is one of them. Music is really near and dear to my heart, and I think about it all the time. Movies as well. And we've been going to this kind of individualistic, there's no set schedule where we have a kind of a social time where everybody in the, unless it's a live event, you know, some sporting event or some news event, we don't have this time where we're all waiting, except maybe for a movie release, which is a beautiful thing, is when a movie releases and everyone's lined up and it's in the things, and I hope we don't lose that, because you're seeing more and more of it day and date. Now people are saying we're going to start streaming it, and maybe it's going to turn more like live events. And so I'm hopeful that just like when live events and you have a big football or rugby match and everybody gets together for a party to have that, maybe there's going to be much more social bonding as opposed to we're just going to watch it on our little screen. There's going to be much more of that special championship kind of like atmosphere for every movie release that's really important.
That's really interesting to hear you say that. As someone who, you know, the iPod is the kind of ultimate sort of personal interaction with music, and to hear you say that you're championing the kind of the live aspect of cinema is maybe unexpected.
You can always have that experience to take with you all the time, whether that's music or film, documentaries, whatever, and you can enjoy it in your own time or rewatch it in a different way. But that social experience of bonding and saying we were there together at that concert when so-and-so did this, or when the movie came out and did that, when it's really a social bonding, a community bonding thing, that's still incredibly important, and I hope we get more of those, because we don't have enough of those. We're losing more and more of those over time, and I hope we're going to have more and more of those kinds of events to bring us all together so that we stay a physical connected, not just virtually connected, set of communities and societies.
And that was a clip from David's conversation with Tony Fadell, who's one of the talking heads in General Magic, which is on out on streaming this week, you said. Great. Up next, we have Film Club, which is another Olivia Assayas film. It's Irma Vep.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary. Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
For his sixth film as director, Olivia Assayas turned his attentions to the French film industry for Irma Vep. Written in 10 days and shot in less than a month, Irma Vep sees Maggie Cheung playing herself, coming to Paris to star in a remake of Louis Feuillade's silent-era serial Les Vampires. But she soon finds herself in the maelstrom of inflated egos and petty squabbles that make up a film set.
And Zoé? Are you friends with Zoé?
Oh, yeah. She takes care of me and I think she's a great person.
Yes. She makes very good costumes.
Yeah.
Do you like your costume?
Yes.
Zoé told me you want to buy it.
Oh.
You really want to buy it? Is it true? Because if you don't buy it, I will buy it.
Well, it's not your size.
I can have it fixed. I like latex.
Latex?
Yes.
Latex?
Like plastic.
Oh, rubber.
Yes, rubber also. It's very sexy.
Mm-hmm. A clip from Irma Vep there. I hadn't seen this film before. It was a first watch for me, but I'd known it mainly because of Maggie Cheung in that cat suit and that amazing scratchy handwritten title treatment. Elena, did you know this film beforehand?
No, I did. I mean, I knew of it, but I hadn't seen it. So this was a first for me.
And?
I really liked it, but I have to say, I'm a bit, not confused by it, but just, it's really strange actually, because I don't know what it really amounts to, but it's so beautifully shot that I was just really impressed by the cinematography. There are all these really like elaborate long takes that just go through rooms and things, and there are, I don't know, about 12 characters at the same time, because it's a film set. And that alone was fascinating. But also, just there are a few characters that are recurrent characters involved in the story. And they're also kind of amazingly well written because they're all people who work on a film. So there's the costume designer, there's the director played by Jean-Pierre Léaud. And they're all just very fun and very interesting. I guess what was really interesting about the movie is because it's on a film set, everyone's really stressed out and everyone's really intense and trying to do their thing. But obviously, getting orders from all sides at the same time, so they all look a bit insane, but at the same time obviously it's real, like that, and also they're French, so obviously they're crazy, but so you have that element of like, at the same time it's quite realistic, but at the same time it's really fun to watch because these people are being a bit crazy trying to make a movie. So I don't know, from that, just that alone is really amazing. Like, it's beautiful and the actors are great and it's really funny, but I think David probably has more to say about that.
Did you see this at the time, David, or was this? Have you seen this earlier than today?
I think I saw it in the early noughts first time and was really baffled by it, to be honest. Like, I don't want to repeat myself from what I said about nonfiction, but it feels like a very, very similar film in a way, in that it's kind of... But it also proves my point about this idea of specificity of subject matter still retaining relevance when you are so specific about things, even though there are all these references to like 90s film and characters discussing Tarantino and John Woo and things like that. The ideas of what journalists are thinking about and what how our actors are kind of responding to journalists is still, you know, that sort of essence of that is very, very interesting. But watching it again recently, I was sort of really struck by this idea of like, I think if I had to pick like one film which represented the 90s, I think this would be it. This feels like absolute peak 90s in that it's kind of looking at where the cinema was, where culture was, looking at globalization. The sort of vague story is you have this old French director who's sort of beloved, and he has this kind of, his idea is he wants to remake Le Vampire, the sort of 1919 serial by Louis Feuillade. But his decision is that he wants to cast Maggie Cheung as Irma Vep, who is this iconic character played by Isadora in the original. You know, he's seen Maggie Cheung in all these like samurai films and like fantasy kung fu films, and there is a sort of like erotic element that he's just completely been bewitched by her, and maybe can't see the sense of why that might not be a good idea of fusing these two kind of cultures. And there are a lot of people who think it's a bad idea because it's like desecrating this like French classic, and Maggie Cheung is very like, it's, I think she's incredible in the film because it's one of the great films about how disconnected an actor is from the material and from the bureaucracy. Like, she's obviously kind of being impacted by decisions that are made and like having to wait on set and having to go places and meet these new people. But there is this whole kind of storm raging and that she's just sort of slightly out of earshot, and she's just there to do her job and get paid and hopefully expand her own portfolio into kind of European or English language cinema and, you know, become a bigger star. So you've just got all these various little stories going on, and it just looks at kind of globalization co-productions and the sort of death of the auteur, or this kind of new wave of like studios, production, mechanized filmmaking. And one of the things I love about this film, which I'm not even sure I know why I love it, is the final shots where you have this, like, what is it, like 30 seconds a minute of like scratchy footage of Irma Vep walking around in her kind of PVC catsuit, and you know the actual kind of celluloid has been scratched and it looks like it's been damaged or something, but it's this absolutely beautiful, completely bewitching segment at the end of the film that's kind of, even when you're sort of doing something wrong, it can be right, or it always sort of comes as a surprise, and I'm always kind of blown away by it.
It is a hard one to get your head around. For me, where nonfiction felt like an old man yelling at the cloud, this is a younger man with his passion for the art form is spilling out in all directions. And it's that fact that the film is in dialogue in that moment that I probably call scuzzy art house in the 90s, where there's this sense of tradition, this sense of the art form, but also the melding of high and low forms of art, and the presence of Maggie Cheung coming off her Hong Kong martial arts work. This is years before In the Mood for Love. I mean, she had done, was she had been in As Tears Go By this point?
Yeah.
She worked with Wong Kar-wai before, of course, but
but she was mainly known for these kind
for
of
Super Cop and things like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And like these Troy Huck films and things like that, where she's basically playing like, you know, it's like Wuxia, you know, like flying kung fu movies.
It really surprised me that she speaks English with an English accent, because she studied both school and uni in the UK, which I didn't know.
I agree with what you're saying. Like, thinking about it now, it just feels like a film from a director. I think he was in his 30s then, like he was quite young. And it's this movie about, he loves the process of making the film as much as he loves the films. And I love the way we are with these people who are very, you know, strung out and very stressed trying to make a movie for like the most of the film, and at the end with this sequence it just opens up in like this pure sort of abstract art thing. And so it's just great to see you can do both, like you can be both like trying to just do your job and like, I'm making the costume, I'm doing this, I'm doing that, and at the end the result is just something. It's not content again, it's just art.
Thank you so much for saying that 30s is still quite young, Eleanor. I'm going to take that home with me.
Well, for a director at least.
I think for everyone, 30s can still be quite young.
And also for podcast people.
Thank you. That's the right answer. Anyway, listeners, if you watch Irma Vep or any of the films we discussed this week, let us know at the usual channels, at Truth and Movies on Twitter, truthandmovies@tcolondon.com via email. And of course, there's the comments section at lwelies.com/podcast. Next week, we'll be back with Terminator Dark Fate. Linda Hamilton, she's due a resurgence, right? We have The Beach Bum, the new film from Harmony Korine. And for Film Club, we're going to revisit one of James Cameron's few flops, which is The Abyss.
I'm a fan.
Oh, you're a fan of The Abyss?
I'm a fan of The Abyss.
I have not seen it.
Oh, well, you'll have to send in your comments if you do watch it. Eleanor, David, thank you so much for joining me this week.
Thank you.
I'm Michael Eder, and as always, this has been a 7 Digital production.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.